America. Welcome to the Rockets Caucus. This is Mark Levine reporting live from Washington, D.C., and I have on the line with me...
Terry D. Kester, producing, speaking live from Oregon.
What are you doing?
I don't know, but it's early in the morning out here.
It is early in the morning out there. It is 12 noon right here in Washington, D.C., AM 1480, We Act Radio. Unfortunately, Garland is out to lunch, at least for now.
Wandering the streets of sagacity.
Are there streets of sagacity?
There are indeed. They are indeed. They're not in Washington, D.C., however, I hate to tell you that.
Well, they clearly aren't, because our government is absolutely shut down. And
yep.
We are careening toward the possibility of a debt crisis as well. And the question is, well, what can possibly stop this nonsense? And what's fascinating to me is that the Democrats are doing something that I think very few of us are used to, and that is holding firm, because that's not something
yes.
that Democrats are generally want to do. It's surprising, those of us who usually see the Democrats squirm and compromise. And what's fascinating is they actually already compromised the story. I don't think that story is getting out enough, but Harry Reid originally basically agreed to John Boehner's demands to continue the sequester, to continue the lower funding levels. But he's basically saying, you know what? No more. And the Republican Party has hit a new low in the history of Gallup polling, which has existed since the end of World War II. There has never been an approval rating this low for an entire political party. It's at 24%. Now, the Democrats don't do too much better. It's 43%. It's definitely less than a majority. But that's, 40-something percent, that's something we've seen before. Definitely not 24%.
Well, I'm thinking, people are beginning to wake up to the fact that the Tea Party is so extreme. The right wing of the Republican Party is so extreme. I think people are in general beginning to wake up to that. I was very pleased in President Obama's last news conference that he actually was very blunt about that, and he hasn't been in the past, that the Republican parties has become extreme, and that they are controlled and dominated and manipulated by an extreme group. There's a study I just read that over the last going all the way back to the 70s, there's an organization that measures whether or not how the political parties shift either to the left or to the right, and how the Democrats may have shifted to the left or stayed in the middle, and how the Republicans have shifted to the right or stayed in the middle. The Democrats in the last decade or so have shifted only slightly, only about a 3% change to the left.
Really, I would think they'd shifted to the right.
Well, if anything, maybe a little bit, but they primarily stayed in what we now call the middle, which was not the same middle as the middle of yesterday. The Republicans, on the other hand, have shifted something like 40 to 50% to the right. They have gone much more extreme in the last decade than the... So it's the equality. I mean, a lot of journalists are reporting, the Democrats do this and the Republicans do that and both sides do this and both sides do that. It's simply not true. The Republicans are doing all kinds of extreme things. The Democrats are not shifting more to the left, have not shifted to the left. They are still primarily in the middle, and I think the Americans are beginning to figure that out.
Well, I hope they are, because the media, I think, feels an obligation to present both sides. And I know that Republicans complain, but the media is secretly liberal. Well, thinking people generally are. But in terms of what they put out publicly, they feel like they have to show both sides. I'll tell you what it reminds me of. I did a study back in college. I did it on Joe McCarthy.
Good old Joe.
Yeah, good old Joseph McCarthy, of course,
yeah.
The guy who held up his laundry list on a plane tarmac in West Virginia. Literally, it was a laundry list, two pants, whatever, and said, I have a list here of communists in the United States government. Everyone says, let me see the list. Nope, not going to show you the list. But he, of course, led to what we now call McCarthyism and a blacklisting of actors throughout the United States, and particularly those with progressive views. And, of course, a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage were communists, and even those weren't communists because they loved the Soviet Union. They were communists because they hated racism or because they wanted equality for workers, or really they were what we would today call socialists or even progressives. But the point of why I'm raising this with Joe McCarthy is the press at that time had a real difficulty in dealing with him. And I actually did a paper on Joe McCarthy in the press, focusing not on McCarthy, whose story is pretty well known, but on the press treatment of him. And what they would do is they felt they had to be fair. So there'd be one headline on the left-hand side. Joe McCarthy says Owen Lattimore is a communist. Okay, Owen Lattimore was some functionary in the United States government. And on the right hand would be a column, an equally sized column, that says Owen Lattimore denies he's a communist. Now, it turns out Owen Lattimore was not a communist, never had been a communist, never was a communist. It was a completely scurrilous charge. But there were equal sides. You know, McCarthy says Owen Lattimore is a communist. Owen Lattimore says he's not a communist. It's kind of like Republicans say there's no climate change, you know, and scientists say there's climate change. Or Republicans say the Earth is flat, but round earthers disagree that the Earth is flat. This idea that you have to show both sides, even when one side is true and the other side is false. And one of the lessons that some people in the press learned from those days, and some obviously did not, is that you do have an obligation not just to show both sides, but to actually do some fact-checking and tell the truth. And that's why at least we have some fact-checkers around today. Whether anyone reads what they say or not but the point is that this is a crisis entirely caused by not even the Republican Party, but the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Because frankly, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, the leaders in the House and the Senate, and I don't like either one of them, but they didn't want this. They have no power over this tiny wing of their party.
And it's only about, really, in the House, it's only about 47 representatives.
Right.
47, 50 representatives that are really on the extreme right, and they are holding, you know, it's not just that the Republicans are holding the country hostage. Those 47 are holding the Republican Party hostage.
That's right. The Tea Party holds the Republican Party hostage, which holds the House of Representatives hostage, which holds the, and of course, the Tea Party is one, you know, it's maybe 20% of the Republican Party in the House, which is a minority party because the majority of Americans voted for Democrats in the House in 2012, but the Republicans still control it because they draw the district lines, which is, of course, one House of Congress, which is one of the three branches of government. It's, as I've said before, it's kind of like the flea on the hair of the tail wagging the dog.
Except that flea has access and support by the oligarchy.
You know, I'm not so sure about that. I think Wall Street, for example, you may be right about the Koch brothers, who obviously got some $60 billion to throw around, which is a lot of money.
Yep.
But I actually think that today Wall Street is starting to say, hey, wait a minute. I mean, you even saw, and these aren't people I love by any stretch, you saw the United States Chamber of Commerce, which is traditionally the group that gives the most billions of dollars to the Republicans. They're the ones who represent interest, big business interests. They're the ones who are so anti-union. You know, 9 times out of 10, or 99 times out of 100, I'm condemning the United States Chamber of Commerce. They joined with Obama last week to condemn the Republicans shutting down the government, which I found incredibly shocking.
It is. It is truly. And maybe there's a shift, you know. We're not going to get the money out of the politics. The Supreme Court will probably make it worse on the upcoming decision about how much campaign money you can give at any given second.
That's the McCutcheon decision.
Yeah. All right. But the question is, can we stop them with the power and the money that they do have? It's not that I think the public is waking up. I think the Chamber of Commerce, you know, at least blinked once and woke up a little bit. But can we stop the oligarchy's power? That's the real question here, because what happens is, and very simply, whether it's Tea Party or it gets some other name or it guises itself some other way, what's really happening is the moderate representative and Republican, and to some degree in the Democrat, if he's the least bit moderate, there's going to be tons of money pointing out that he's basically a traitor to America, and therefore you have to elect this fascist who's really going to help you. And the amount of money behind that campaign and these campaigns is phenomenal, and that's how they keep on gaining power, and they do it in the districts, as you pointed out, that they control. They do it in rural districts. They do it in poor districts where people, frankly, don't have the access to information. And it's amazingly powerful, amazingly powerful.
I'll tell you one way I think we could really play a major role in stopping this, and we need to have a movement to do this, is if you were to get rid of the gerrymandered lines,
oh,
that
yeah.
would change everything. And by the way, that's not impossible. In Iowa, forever, I don't know, for many, many decades, they've had nonpartisan district lines, and the four congressional seats of Iowa are always up for grabs in every election. California had passed a proposition that, frankly, Democrats opposed. I got to tell you this. I opposed it because I thought they were going to allow fairer lines. And I thought, well, you know what? The Democrats are gerrymandering themselves some good lines. And it's only fair because every other state is gerrymandered with the Republican Party in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida and Michigan and the whole Texas and a whole bunch of other states. But lo and behold, and again, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Republican, supported getting rid of gerrymandering in California. It was a popular vote. The Democrats opposed it. The Republicans supported it. Shocking thing happened in the 2012 election. When you got rid of the gerrymandered lines, which were designed to protect Democratic interests in the state of California, more Democrats won seats. Shocked the Democratic Party because they thought, well, you know, well, we could draw lines. Because it turns out when you allow people to vote for whom they want to vote for, yeah, the shifts can be more dramatic, but hey, that's democracy. It seems to me that in the 13-odd states, or maybe more, maybe 15 to 20 states, where they have direct democracy, if we were to put just a general nationwide end gerrymandered campaign, that would change everything because it's the gerrymandered district lines, drawing lines that include, you know, mostly Republicans, that causes Republicans not to look to the middle of the country, but to look over their shoulder to the right because of fear of a primary challenge.
I mean, are there really 13 states that have, you know, very strong anti-gerrymandering?
No, they're not. But there are 13 states that have direct democracy, that have referenda processes, or where you can petition.
Right. Okay.
So what I'm saying is, Iowa's done it for years. California's now done it for about 4 years. But the point is that this is something that's not going to be done through the legislatures because God knows the Republicans are not going to allow that through a legislature they control. But if you were to do it through direct democracy, they can't stop that, and that is a way to actually take back the country, state by state.
That's a very good point, Mark. That's a very good point.
Because, well, thank you.
Oregon is one of those states where you have direct democracy, and that is not an issue that has come up.
It's a lot of Western states. It tends to.
Yeah, it probably should be in almost every state that has that power, and that's a one of those little trends that might make a huge difference. Well, it would make a huge difference.
As I said, California surprised everybody because everyone thought that meant, because legislators have been protecting their seats there just like they do in every other state. And a lot of people, I feared, well, wait a minute, we have to gerrymander back because they're gerrymandering these states. But it turns out it actually helped the Democrats. The real problem states, though, unfortunately, are in the states that don't tend to have direct democracy, the ones in the East. Again, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan. These are states that are either blue or purple states. All four of those states voted for President Obama. And Pennsylvania and Michigan voted for him in a substantial numbers. Ohio and Florida, they were very close. But all four of those states, Republicans control some three-quarters of the congressional seats in states that are either blue or purple. And the reason they do so is entirely because of the lines drawn. And the reason they control the state legislatures in Florida and Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Texas is because, well, see, Texas is different because Texas really is majority Republican. It is a red state. But
Texas is different for a whole lot of reasons.
Well, right. But the point is, at least in the other four states I mentioned, those are blue purple states that should be Democratic or middle of the road states. And they're, John Boehner's from Ohio, right? A lot of the Tea Party people are from Florida. And the reason why these states are so radical is not because even the people in those states are radical. Florida is the classic purple state. We remember that from 2000. The reason is because of the way they draw the district lines. And if a campaign can be started to stop those things, I mean, I'd love to see, frankly, a federal law that basically bans gerrymandering nationwide.
Has that ever been proposed?
No.
Kucinich probably was the only person that might have proposed that.
No, because people want to protect their seats. That's how.
And that is the essential problem. And what's the frightening thing about America, and I've been thinking about it a lot, what is our future and which way are we headed? And on one side of me, it's very optimistic because there is so much that's happening in technology. There's so much happening in the arts. It's incredible what's happening in the arts. It's just a flood of creativity. And at the same time, the country is basically seeking the lowest common denominator on almost every single political, social, cultural issue. I don't know if we're in Renaissance or if we're in hell, but the power of the money, the power of the oligarchy, and again, just reading another report just today, that it has shifted again to even more power than it's ever been before. The top 1%, they do control what happens in the industries in this country. They do control what happens in the Chamber of Commerce, and they control what's happening politically. How are we ever going to permeate that, prevent that? And if this McCutcheon decision goes the way I think it's going to go with the Supreme Court, we've lost control entirely.
Well, let's talk about the McCutcheon decision, because a lot of people don't know it, just like they didn't know about Citizens United before it came about. So basically, there's been laws in place since Watergate, because at the time of Watergate, Congress and the American people had this crazy idea, Terry. It was that perhaps limiting the massive amounts of money people use to buy politicians might limit corruption. Now, that idea is completely discounted by the right wing today. The idea, because they think that buying politicians is part of our capitalist system. You go to McDonald's, you pick up a couple burgers, you go to the Capitol, you pick up a couple congressmen. Apparently, you can just do the drive-through window now at the Capitol. You deposit, I think it's $10 million per, and yes, you put it in, and you get to keep a certain congressman.
And you get no fries, but
you can get some $1 billion in corporate welfare. Depending on how many congressmen you buy, it's kind of a bulk deal. So Sean McCutcheon is this rich businessman in Alabama.
How unusual that a rich businessman should bring this to our attention.
Alabama is that wonderfully liberal state where the county that was just caught discriminating against black people sued for the right to keep black people from voting, and which was upheld, apparently, by the 5 justices of the Supreme Court. That's Shelby County in Alabama. Anyway, so Sean McCutcheon only can give $123,000 to Republican candidates each election cycle. Federal.
That's a direct contribution. That has nothing to do with PACs.
That's exactly right. He can give $123,000 directly to federal political candidates and to the Republican Party. But he can still give more to state and local parties, and he can give more to super PACs, not to PACs, but super PACs, which can run issue ads. He can give millions to them, and he can give millions to corporations, which he can then give unlimited money through Citizens United. But he can only give $123,000 directly.
It's heartbreaking. It's really
well, it is, because he really wants to support more than that. And, you know, there's so many Americans that want to spend more than $123,000. I actually looked it up.
How many Americans are there that want to spend more?
There's less than 2,000. In fact, I was surprised it was over 1,000. Apparently, it is over 1,000, but less than 2,000. But in any case, 2,000 Americans is point. Let me do my math right. There's 300 million Americans, so that's half of a tenth of 1%.
Yeah, about, I think you're right.
Half of a tenth of 1%, something like that.
Calculator.
So it's not the biggest number in the world, but basically, under McCutcheon, when the Supreme Court rules, as I fear they will, 5-4, that there's nothing wrong with buying politicians, that in fact bribery and graft is a long American tradition, which they'd be right about that.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that if you go back to our real history.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mythology.
The point is now they can give $3.6 million. Now, I don't know that all of the 1,000-plus Americans who want to give more than $123,000 will want to give $3.6 million. But Justice Scalia at oral argument said, and I quote, $3.6 million, that's not a heck of a lot of money, unquote. Which made me think, Justice Scalia, will you buy me a couple houses, maybe a small island or something? Because I think to many Americans, $3.6 million is a heck of a lot of money, particularly when you think about it not even as net worth, but it's just pocket spending, right? I mean, you know, every 2 years, you want to spend $3.6 million on a political candidate. So, you know, over 10 years, or 20 years, that's $36 million. Not a lot of people have that in their wallets.
Not very few.
No, the World Series of Poker, I'm a poker player, gives this huge cash prize of $8 million, and that's considered a lot of money.
Have you won?
I have not yet. No, it's a $10,000 entry fee, and yeah, exactly. So I don't think I'm quite ready to go yet.
It's back to the street corners if you want the good games.
Well, yeah, no, I actually may end up going up to the new casino in Maryland. I haven't done that yet, where it's a $65 game, which I'm willing to spend if I have to.
No, okay.
But in any case, the point is that for Scalia, that's not a heck of a lot of money. For the Koch brothers, that's not a heck of a lot of money. When you make when you're worth $30 billion. 3 million is 0.01%. I mean, it's 1/10,000th of your income, of your net wealth.
He actually said this in his
opening. He did. That's a quote. $3.6 million is, quote, not a heck of a lot of money, unquote. And the reason why it's not, in Scalia's view, is because there was some $6 billion spent on all federal elections combined. That's the president, members of Congress, House, Senate, primaries, general campaign, and all candidates.
Which is obscene even in itself.
It is. But even that $6 billion is kind of pocket change when you compare it to one, not both, one Koch brother, each of which is worth about $36 billion. You know, he could pay a sixth of his net wealth and spend more than every single person in America or around the globe on every election, federal election, every election year.
And you add to that the four members of the Walmart.
There you go.
Et cetera. I mean,
yeah, they got $100 billion or something. They got more than the Koch brothers.
They make the Koch brothers look like amateurs.
Exactly. So the question is there anything wrong with bribery? Is there anything wrong with buying politicians?
Do we legalize it? That's the whole American philosophy.
Well, and I would argue it's already pretty legal. It's just going to be even more legal. And that, of course, is what McCutcheon v. FEC is all about. The irony is there's so few restrictions that exist, but McCutcheon is chafing under one of the few that remain.
And do you have any inclination from where you stand that the Supreme Court might go against it? I mean, it looks like the best we're going to get is 5-4, and that's five in the wrong direction.
Yeah, no, I think that's what's, I've actually been pretty good at predicting Supreme Court decisions lately. I predicted they would dismantle the Voting Rights Act. I predicted that they would uphold the Affordable Care Act. I wish I could give you a more optimistic prediction, but I unfortunately predict it will be 5-4. That
one time I'm not going to bet against you.
Yeah, they're gonna overturn these laws.
You know what? Besides this $3.6 billion not being a lot of
million.
What is the argument that the court could possibly state that says?
Oh, it's simple.
That we can't limit our election process.
Well, it's simple. It's
simple. Constitution that says we cannot limit how things are done.
Oh, yes, sure there is, Terry. It's the First Amendment, you see. See, money is speech.
I keep on forgetting that money is free. That must be, why I just, haven't, the world hasn't been listening to me. I don't have enough billions.
That's it, right. Money is speech. And according to the Supreme Court, the First Amendment does not apply to all Americans equally. If you're rich, if you have $1 billion, you have 1 million times more speech than someone who has $1,000. Got it?
I mean, doesn't it seem to you, and it seems to me, and it seems to most Americans in just common sense, that the Supreme Court, at least these five, and the conservatives, and enemies of the people like Scalia, are really just playing with words. I mean, how you can take the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and apply that to money has never, ever made any sense whatsoever. It just simply does not make any sense. It's not what the First Amendment was written about.
I'll tell you how they look at it. They look at it back in the day when people used to print out their own newspapers or their own, posters, right? Certainly someone can print out, can buy poster board and print out, the government is wrong, or I disagree with the government on immigration or guns or whatever, and they can, that we have a right to do. So they extrapolated that to, well, you have the right to do your own printing press, which I think you do. I think any American has the right to print out their own newspaper and print it out. Then they extrapolated further, and they said, well, and you can buy ads on TV, because that's like a newspaper. All right, okay, that's a little pushing it, that's a little bit further, but okay. And then they go further and say, and then you can funnel money into corporations that can use other people's money that can then funnel into elections, and that's where it goes too far. And now they go even further and say you can give the money directly to the candidates so they can fund free speech to help themselves. which I think is where we've come full circle. So they actually take a principle that I think is correct, and they just extrapolate it so far that you can't recognize it anymore.
So they're caught in extrapolation. That's sad. That is sad.
They've been extrapolated to death. You know, and there's really an easy answer, and it's one that, well, every other Western nation uses. You know, I don't know why America is so loath to look at countries that we respect, you know, England and France and Germany and the Netherlands and Canada.
Why would we look at countries that we respect, which we really don't respect?
Well, I guess we don't.
Countries. No, but, you know, when we are the best, and we know that, and America is absolutely unique, and any good idea comes from America, and no good ideas come from any place else, why would we look anywhere else?
I don't know. We seem to like the English royalty, but we don't look at the English parliamentary system.
Is there something in the Constitution about national narcissism that I missed?
That's a good question.
47 or something.
I don't think that one's in there. But what they do in England, what they do in Canada, what they do in every Western nation that I'm aware of, is they have public financing of campaigns. They, and then actually you say, well, how do you know how much to fund? The answer is they take how much the parties did in the last election, you know, so that way you don't have to fund, you know, the American Nazi Party. You'd fund them to the tune of 0.0000001%. You give them, you know, $3.12 or whatever they earned in their last election. So you don't have to worry about, people always say, well, what about the minor parties? And if the minor parties do better, if the Greens do better in the next election, they get more money in the next election. But you put the money in based on the percentage in the last election, and that means the Democrats and Republicans would be roughly equal because, you know, 51-47 or whatever. And that money goes, it's incorruptible. It's based on an objective source, namely the last election. And what it does, and you bar private money going to these parties. That doesn't mean people can't still buy newspapers. You can still buy newspapers. I mean, the Buckley v. Valeo decision, which said that basically you can do your own issue ads, I actually think that makes sense under the First Amendment. You can do your own issue ads if this is important, you disclose who you are, because I don't think you have a right to anonymous free speech tarring someone.
What is free speech if you aren't hidden?
Right.
I mean, there's sort of an oxymoron there, is there not?
Yeah, I think
ideally, I mean, I understand, you know, that if you had free speech in every area, and if you spoke up on every issue, you're liable to be shunned, shot, etc.
That's the cost.
Yeah.
That's the cost of free speech. I mean, the reason why the Ku Klux Klan has a right to march, and they do, is because we know who they are, and they have a right to be shunned and attacked, and not attacked physically, but attacked verbally.
Well, we know who they are today, but we didn't know who they were just a few years ago.
That's why they wore masks.
Yes, exactly.
But that's exactly it. I don't think you have a clear right to anonymous free speech. If you put up a poster in the middle of the town square that says whatever it says and then says anonymous, I don't know that right necessarily exists.
Has that ever been challenged in the Supreme Court? I mean, this anonymity, I mean, that seems to be essential too. I mean, if they're going to make these atrocious decisions that the more money you have, the more speech you have, you know, which really makes no democratic logic whatsoever. But if they're going to support that, aren't there any cases or any laws that say in even states, et cetera, that you have to identify yourself?
I think you should have to stand by your decisions. There are laws against libel and slander. If you put a law, if you put up something that, if I say that Terry DeKester was behind the Washington sniper attacks, and I say that not hypothetically, but as if it were true, that would be quite slanderous, and it would, you know, harm your already low reputation, Terry. And
compared to the lawsuit harming your reputation.
That's true, actually. And you could sue me, exactly right, and you could get damages. And if I put out anonymously and you traced it to me, you could still sue me for damages, because you're never truly anonymous. It's not just the fact that we have the right to free speech, but there are consequences of speech. And if you stand for a position, you should have to stand for that position.
You are the Koch brothers, are the millionaires,
right?
And somehow that has been absolutely ignored.
They put out Americans for Prosperity, which is kind of like Americans for Puppy Dogs and Rainbows. And you know, or oil company puts out the Clean America Coalition. I don't know, that's not a real name. I'm just something like that. I have to look up the real name, but
it
you
will
know,
be.
Which makes it sound like they're an environmental organization, but they're not. They're the greatest polluters in the country. So that's exactly right. I would be less worried about free speech if I knew that someone was standing behind it, and that's why I like the campaign laws that say I am candidate X and I approve this message. We should.
Yeah.
absolutely know where the messages are coming from.
Or at least that it's connected, you know, to a particular politician, and he's actually admitting that that's part of his campaign.
That's right. That's right. Because anonymous speech is actually far, far more dangerous than even rich people's speech. I'm going to take a quick break, give people a chance to call in if they wish. It's 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is the Raucous Caucus with Mark Levine and Terry DeKester, and we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, and I have on the line with me
Terry DeKester.
And we are the Raucous Caucus today because Garland Nixon is AWOL. He apparently AWOL. Has to
lost,
work today.
Lost in the maze of sagacity.
Lost in the maze of sagacity, I suppose. So we're talking about, of course, the government shutdown because I'm here in Washington, D.C., and it's a ghost town. I see sagebrush rolling across the streets.
Oh, that means Texas is taking over. To begin with, now moved in, Mark. Watch out.
They probably are. And that's sort of the issue we have. We have a tiny minority that is controlling everything. And I do not believe.
That really needs to be stressed. Basically, we're talking about 47 congressmen who are impacting jobs and the economy around the entire United States, not just Washington.
And around the world, because now we're talking about risking default.
47 people.
We're talking about risk and representing, you know, maybe 10% of the country, right? 435 representatives in the House of Representatives.
Maximum.
Right. Maximum 10% of the country. So here's what I find really interesting. The Gallup poll, as I mentioned, shows the Republican Party the lowest that's ever been, that any party has ever been in American history. But it's 2013. It's October 2013. In October 2009, the Democrats were also way above the Republicans in public opinion polls, but by 2010, we all know there was a rout and Republicans really won that election. Mm-hmm. I do not think this crisis, this self-imposed crisis, would happen if this were October 2014, because then the Republicans would lose in a rout, and we'd finally have Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. We'd be able to do some good things and frankly, get rid of a lot of this nonsense. But it is a year away, and what's fascinating to me is that traditionally, if you look at American history, the first year after a presidential reelection is that president's most powerful year. They've just won, so the first 4 years, they're worried about reelection. The last two years of an 8-year term, they're lame duck. But the fifth and sixth year, that's when all the great things happen. Lyndon Johnson, for example, just got reelected in 1964, and boom, in 1965, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act. You find Bill Clinton did a lot of his big initiatives just after a reelection in 1997, Family Medical Leave Act. And also when they're first elected, like President Obama did Affordable Care Act in his first year. So this should be Obama's big year. And I think the Republicans are betting that they can ruin any forward progress in America, truly harm the economy, and then by 2014 act a little more reasonably, and they hope Americans will forget this month, this week. And I fear they're right. I fear that people won't remember this moment a year from now.
I'm not quite that pessimistic, or maybe not quite that optimistic. I don't know which it is anymore. Because what's going to counter that is that the Affordable Care Act will succeed by 2014. And it doesn't mean it'll succeed, you know, universally, but it will. Basically.
It'll make things better. It won't make things perfect. It'll make things better.
It'll make things better. And whether or not they can actually destroy the economy, you know, there's so many factors in the economy. Warren Buffett's not the least bit worried, you know. Well, he's worried by the shutdown, to be sure. But
they're worried more about the possibility of default on the debt.
Default on the debt, yeah. Which would be, as far as I've heard, you know, that'd be the first time that's ever happened.
Ever.
The only time.
It's never happened. It didn't happen in the Revolutionary War. It didn't happen in the Civil War.
Well, it actually did happen in the Revolutionary War in the sense that most of the states, the colonies at that time, could not pay their debts.
But the Continental Congress paid every penny back after we became a country.
Which is what which was part of the agreement that led to the capital being moved to Washington, because Virginia was one of the few states or one of the few colonies that had paid its debts. And so they had all the bargaining power.
That makes sense.
So there was a time when we weren't paying, but it was only in the very beginning.
Before we were a United States of America, before the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. Even after the Constitution, they still had, the states were still behind on it, and then that's what getting the Congress to approve all, to pay all of the debts was the deal, to make sure that the that our capital moved to Washington D.C.
Right, but the point is, in President Washington's first term, the debts were paid, and they've been paid ever since. And during the Civil War, which, of course, when you think about it, I mean, more Americans died in the Civil War than all of our other wars combined. It's not just huge amounts of blood, but, of course, debt. And the Union had to print paper money. I actually have, that my grandfather gave me, I have a Union quarter, which is actually printed paper. It's a bill. It's a 25-cent bill. Because they ran out of silver to coin, or copper, or any kind of coinage, and they had to actually print paper money. It's the only time they did that was in the 1860s, prior to the Federal Reserve in 1913.
Is it illogical of me, Mark, to suggest that, you know, since you raised the Civil War, that we should go back a little bit in history? Now, I know this presents all kinds of racial issues and everything else, and we have to prevent slavery, but couldn't we let the South just go? I mean, you know, that might mean Virginia, too. I'm sorry, but...
Well, hey, Virginia's becoming purple. My home state has come a long way. It's not there yet, but and speaking of my home state, by the way, there is an election in just 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, in Virginia. And Terry McAuliffe, I think, will be the next governor of Virginia. And please, if you're listening to my voice, and We Act Radio is heard throughout a lot of Northern Virginia, do not forget to vote. It's a great, great point. It's the first Thursday in November. I believe it's November 7th. Tuesday. What am I saying? November 5th.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my calendar here. I'm looking at Thursday. Tuesday, November 5th. It's not just the governor, Terry McAuliffe, but you've got to vote for Ralph Northam. He's the lieutenant governor running, because the guy running against him is absolutely crazy.
Crazier than Cuccinelli.
Yeah, Cuccinelli is a nasty fellow. Well, let's talk about the Republican ticket, and I'll talk about the Democratic ticket. And this gives me a great segue, because I want to show that Virginia can be a rational state. So the guy running for governor, Cuccinelli, is a guy who wants to bring back sodomy laws in Virginia, laws that prevent consensual sex between man and wife. If it's oral sex is what Cuccinelli wants to bring back as a law, prohibiting oral sex between married couples in Virginia, which is crazy. He also wants to make it much harder to get contraception. He wants to allow blatant...
How does that apply to oral sex?
That's a I did something different.
Has Cuccinelli explained that? Or are they tied together somehow or other?
Well, it's all part of this wish to control people's bodies that is in some... what they call social conservatism.
Percentage? Has Cuccinelli got a chance?
Well, Terry McAuliffe is ahead. He's ahead by some 5 to 10 points. Not dramatically ahead, but I do think Terry McAuliffe is going to eke it out, which will be great for Virginia. But I want to make sure people know about Ralph Northam and Mark Herring, because they're running for lieutenant governor and attorney general. And there are people who say, well, Cuccinelli's crazy. And lieutenant governor the guy running for lieutenant governor is crazy. Cuccinelli, that's Reverend what's his last name? I don't remember his last name. He's a preacher who has said that gay people are perverted, and said that the Planned Parenthood is like the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, he's actually crazier than Cuccinelli. I think he's going to lose, and a very mild-mannered doctor who's a state senator in Virginia will win, Ralph Northam. I'm actually most concerned about the attorney general's race, because Attorney General has tremendous power in Virginia. Cuccinelli used that power. In fact, it's the reason why Virginia is not participating in the Affordable Care Act. It's the reason why he sued to allow discrimination against gay people in Virginia, because universities were not discriminating, and he felt they should, and he sued the universities, the state universities, to require them to discriminate against gay people when they didn't want to. Amazing guy. So, but the guy, so Mark Herring is, again, good, moderate state senator, Democrat. I think he'll make a great attorney general. He's running against a guy named Randy Obenshain, who had a bill, didn't pass, had a bill that if you had a miscarriage, it had to be reported to the police within 48 hours so they didn't think you accidentally had an abortion. You had to report a miscarriage and to the police. And I guess they could come and investigate to see whether you intentionally caused that miscarriage or whether it was an accident.
You know, I lived in Virginia most of my life. I mean, I really did. And I have just not witnessed that kind of insanity in
the
years that I lived there.
That bill didn't pass, but the guy who proposed the bill is running for attorney general. So I got to encourage everybody listening to my voice, even if you don't agree with some of the Democratic views, look, you don't have to worry about Terry McAuliffe and Mark Herring and Ralph Northam going, you know, wild and actually helping unions and so forth, because the legislature in Virginia is solidly Republican, and it will be solidly Republican for 10 years to come because of the way they've drawn the district lines. So if you are a moderate, even if you're a Republican, and you don't support the craziness that is represented on the Republican ticket, you can, it's okay to vote a straight Democratic ticket because you're still going to have a Republican legislature and you'll have balance in Virginia rather than complete crazies, you know, taking over the store. Plus there's corruption. Don't forget about corruption. McConnell is the governor, and he's the one who's taken tens of thousands of dollars from this Williams guy, the Star Scientific guy, to promote his company. He's probably going to be indicted soon. Cuccinelli is taking money from the same place. There's a lot of corruption.
That's why the Supreme Court has to decide that you can give any kind of money any place you want. That's exactly what it's about. They're trying to protect McConnell.
Here's what I find so interesting about what McConnell did is that he was required to disclose. That's the issue. He could actually take the money legally. He can take a huge amount of bribes legally, but he's required to disclose the money, and he didn't. And that was part of the problem.
I worry about Virginia. I really do.
It is a problem, and I don't know what we're going to do about it.
Well,
but
you know,
I know what we're going to do about it. We're going to vote. We're going to vote come November 5th.
But it does, you know, Virginia does reflect the dilemma in the United States in total. I mean, it's just we have this whole movement of people who are truly, I mean, I know they're sincere in what they believe, so I will give them that. But they are just totally out of line with any ideas of responsible democracy.
I don't know that they're all sincere. I'll tell you, I mean, okay, the Rand Pauls of the world.
Cuccinelli is not sincere. You'd have to be sincere to make those stupid
comments. Cuccinelli is probably sincere, but you know who's not is a guy like John Boehner. I mean, the Speaker of the House has said that he didn't want this, and you know what? That I believe him. He didn't want to shut the government down. He was against it from the get-go. But
doesn't that make him the most gutless man in Washington, D.C.? He's the only one that has any power, if there is any power, over Congress. He's the only one that could stand up and say, this is just total nonsense. These people are out of line. I don't care if they vote against me on this and that and everything else. This is so wrong that you Republicans, you fellow Republicans, cannot go along with these 47 individuals who are trying to destroy the economy. Isn't he the most gutless man in Washington?
They're calling him Sino, Speaker in name only. You know, you're sort of dinos and rhinos, Democrats name only, Republicans. He's Speaker in name only. It is particularly pathetic because to end the crisis now, which of course is a self-imposed crisis, it's kind of like a guy who's jumping off a bridge and then claiming, I'm drowning. But to end the self-imposed crisis, all John Boehner has to do, and he could do it today and it would be done in an hour, is call a vote on reopening the government. Because a solid majority of the House of Representatives, I dare say two-thirds of the House, would vote to do that, because you've got the 45% that are Democrats. They're all going to vote for it. And you probably got a third to maybe even a half of Republicans.
I've even heard as many as, you know, so over 100 Republicans.
Well, that's exactly right. So 100 Republicans plus, you know, 200 Democrats, that's 300 votes. That's two-thirds of the House. You know who's in charge of that vote? One person. And that's the Speaker of the House. And if the Speaker of the House weren't worried about his job, and not even his job right away, I mean, he's not even reelected until January 2015, and he's going to lose his job anyway if, as Speaker of the House, if the majority of Americans, vote for and elect Democrats to the House of Representatives. So he, this one guy worried about his job and being gutless, as you said, is the reason why we're in the mess we're in.
I mean, is anybody challenging him in that sense? I mean, you know.
It's personal. It's his job versus the rest of the country.
It's his job.
Someone needs to do that. So Wolf Blitzer needs to say, now, Speaker Boehner, if you called a vote tomorrow, we all know there'd be a vote. He's like, I don't know if there would. Well, there's an easy way to find out. Just call the vote.
Yeah, I guess that's what's really kind of discouraging. You know, we've got, you were talking about McCarthy in the very beginning. And, you know, finally, what, there's a lot of things that finally brought McCarthy down. But it was finally people speaking up against him, people of stature, people of political power.
Sure.
And then his own party, in fact, you know.
Yeah, Edward R. Murrow, very famously.
Yeah, and we just don't seem to have that kind of guts anymore. You know, everything is about preserving whatever little corner you've got left, as opposed to standing up for something that is just, that is fair, that is honest, and challenging, you know, Boehner directly. You know, what is wrong with you? We know you don't want to be this. Why won't you have the courage to say to the 47 congressmen, you are out of line?
Do you know who I want to see make the Sunday rounds? It may surprise you. I want to see John McCain. John McCain has very publicly said that the Tea Party is wacko. They said that this was a crazy strategy. He said it. But I don't see him. I see Ted Cruz making the Sunday morning rounds. John McCain. Everyone, Americans know who John. They may not even know who Ted Cruz is. They know who John McCain is. John McCain ran for president in 2008. Yeah. He got 47% of the vote. I mean, that's a substantial. He got 100 million votes or so. That's not pocket change. John McCain needs to publicly come out and say, this is ridiculous. This is not my Republican Party. These people shouldn't be in the Republican Party. They should put their country first. Remember, that was his campaign slogan, country first. And I want to see him take a much louder, stronger stand. He's on the correct side of this issue, but he's been too quiet, in my view.
What would happen if we allowed third party, if we made it possible for third party, and if the Tea Party became a third party, would that make it more impotent, or would that make it more dangerous?
It would make it more impotent, and so I say go. Go Tea Party, go. Become a third party.
It shouldn't be part of the Republican Party. I mean, it's a disgrace.
Well, it is, and it's bringing the Republican Party down. And at some point, and you know what, and as a Democrat, I like that, but as an American, I'm concerned. I mean, are we really going to default for no reason? Here we're fighting a massive civil war, and hundreds of thousands of Americans are slaughtering each other in cold blood over a very important issue, slavery. I mean, the country is in convulsions, and we're still paying our debts. But a few Republicans don't want to allow middle-class people to have health care, and they're going to shut down the government, and they're going to cause us to default when Lincoln didn't do it in the middle of the Civil War?
Well, you know, going back all the way back to the founding, George Washington really warned against having a two-party system.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You know, you just wanted a general democracy. You did not want to have these political parties, and maybe good old George was right.
Factions. You know, I don't know that we can stop it. I think, I mean, the Constitution was developed not to have it, and we have it anyway. Maybe there's just too much in American or British or human, we can't, everyone just doesn't just vote for the greater good. They have to join in parties and all. I've given up on getting rid of political parties.
It'd be rather major accomplishment, I have to admit.
But the thing we could do, though, is we should start a petition to remove the Speaker of the House. Here's what you do.
Remove. What do you mean?
Here's what happens.
You don't mean remove the office. You mean remove Boehner.
Remove Boehner. Or go around him. So here's the deal. It is true that 99.999% of the time, the Speaker of the House controls the agenda on the House floor. What he or she does when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker, what he or she does is they put forward what they want to put forward. They pack the Rules Committee with their own allies, and the Rules Committee puts forward their plan. The rule is always voted on by the majority, and in this case, Boehner doesn't want to vote to continue to fund the government. There is one and only one little loophole. There's one way around the Speaker of the House. It's called a discharge petition. It's very rare. But what it is basically if something sits in committee for 30 days, then you get a majority of members of Congress, 218 members, to sign on saying, we want to vote on this, then you automatically get a vote. And the only time I know that's happened in modern history was the McCain-Feingold bill. limiting, ironically, public financing, limiting private money going to campaigns. The Speaker of the House, Jenny Hastert at the time, Republican, and Tom DeLay refused to allow it to come to the floor because they knew that, politicians couldn't vote against laws that would limit corruption in Congress. And so they just didn't allow it to come to the floor because they wanted that corruption and bribery. But this discharge petition eventually worked, and it went around them. The problem with the discharge petition is that it takes a long time. Usually something has to sit 30 days. We don't have 30 days. But they should still pass it around, and every Democrat would sign on. And let's see if Peter King, who talks a good game, let's see if he would sign on. Let's see if some of the moderate Republicans would sign on. And it's a way to put them to the test to say, all right, you say you're a moderate Republican. You say that you care more about your country than the Tea Party. Okay, Peter King, you sign on. And once we get 200 Democratic names, and all we need is 18 Republican names, which we could easily, you know, then the process starts. And even though it would take 30 days, that would be a clear sign that the Speaker is being rolled. And then he could say, well, you know, they already did this discharge petition, so I've got
to move forward. Why hasn't Pelosi done this?
The reason they haven't done it is because they feel like Republicans would be loath to sign on to a petition that has 200 Democratic names. They want it to, Peter King wants the Speaker to call for it. But I think it's time to put them to the test. I think also because it's slow. I mean, there are people that say, well, you know, this whole process could take 30, 60, you know, days, and we don't have that much time.
No, but I mean, it would achieve some political momentum.
I think so.
And it's the kind of thing that, again, you know, where are the courageous Democrats that aren't pushing for this?
Well, they need to do that. There's some people that argue that when you're trying to argue with a terrorist, you need to not embarrass them publicly. So maybe that's the reason why they haven't done it. I don't know. We got a caller on the line. Let's see who this is. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. Who's this?
Hi, this is Michael S.W. from Bronx, New York City.
Hello, Michael from the Bronx. We only got a few minutes left, so make your comment quickly, please.
Well, I just got out of church. I was hoping you were talking about the government shutdown.
Of course, we are.
Okay. I just want to reiterate the point, if I haven't, that this whole thing about President Obama not wanting to negotiate. Number one, there's nothing to negotiate here when it comes to Obamacare. It is the law. It has been settled by the Supreme Court. Both sides of the Congress have voted in, and President Obama signed it in. Why these Tea Parties keep wanting to repeal it, and then want to say the law is the law, is beyond me. And the other part is that President Obama has bent over backwards for the past 5+ years trying to negotiate with these Republicans, not just on Obamacare, but just about anything. And these Republicans keep slamming the door on his face.
That's true.
So let's get real here.
Two solid points, Michael. I'm going to cut you off, but I appreciate you making your 2 points, and I'm going to ask Terry to comment on them.
You need to grow up, bottom line.
That's true.
Well, that is Michael does bring up, you know, my primary concern. You know, Obama, who I have great respect for. I really honestly do. I think he's done some enormous things, many of which we don't even recognize at this point because they don't seem that big, but they are huge. Things like limiting the prosecutions of drug offenders, et cetera. It's a phenomenal step. But
And also in immigration, making children who haven't committed a crime not be deported, or the Lilly Ledbetter Act, frankly, making sure that women are paid equally to men. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things people forget that he's done, but go ahead.
But he does believe in compromise, and I do too, you know, and compromise is what makes a democracy work. But this seems to be a point where you cannot compromise, and I am a little afraid that he will.
I'm a little afraid that he will, too. I put out a tweet when this thing first happened a couple weeks ago, and I put, Republicans are demanding that Obama resign or they will burn down the White House. Obama strangely refusing to negotiate. And then I put out, if this were to happen, CNN would have a press release. President refuses to negotiate on possibility of White House burning. You know?
And has moved out.
Exactly. And so there is a point beyond, here's how you know that this is unfair, because if you try to take off your partisan hat and take off your progressive hat and say, well, why isn't Obama negotiating, which is what this is the talking point Republicans are putting forward that Michael points out. Here's how you know it's unfair. The negotiation is not about the budget. It's not about the government continuing. It's, as Michael points out, it's about the Affordable Care Act. So Democrats could do the exact same thing in return. They could say, look, we don't believe that mentally ill people should be able to have AK-47s. Republicans do believe that mentally ill people and terrorists should have AK-47s. We disagree. We tried to pass a law through Congress, and it failed. I mean, I was very upset about that, but it did fail. Now, we're going to shut down the government, ruin the economy, unless we have background checks for guns. Now, what would the Republicans? They would go crazy. How dare you? You didn't pass it through Congress. You can't get things. Well, that's exactly what they're doing. They're trying to get things that they could not pass through Congress.
You raise the biggest point, is this cannot become a pattern.
Right.
And it cannot continue that every few months we have to, you know, raise the debt ceiling, et cetera, et cetera. It has to be taken in a long-term view. And, if the Democrats were to do something like that, they, in fact, then would be almost institutionalizing the pattern. And that would be economically disastrous.
And frankly, politically, it would ruin our democracy because it would say that whoever is willing to throw the bomb of shutting down the government wins.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't matter what the American people wanted. It wouldn't matter what the majority wanted. Do you know, by the way, who brought us the modern debt ceiling? Do you know that, Terry?
No, I do not.
I'll give you a hint. His first name is Newt. I don't even know if you know this. Most people don't know this. The modern debt ceiling went away in the 1970s.
Bring Newt into my life.
No, please. I'm sorry. He's in our life because Dick Gephardt did something in the 1970s called the Gephardt Rule. And the Gephardt Rule was these debt ceilings are really causing damage to America. So what he said is anytime you vote to spend more than you tax, you automatically raise the debt ceiling to cover it. And it's called the Gephardt Rule. And so the debt ceiling, by the way, didn't even exist till World War I. But then since the 1970s, it completely went away. And Democrats never threatened to shut the government down when Ronald Reagan was president or George Bush Sr. was president because we had this Gephardt Rule that said the debt ceiling automatically goes up. In 1995, in order to confront Bill Clinton when he was particularly popular, Newt Gingrich, right after coming to power, reinstituted the debt ceiling, got rid of the Gephardt Rule. And so Newt Gingrich is actually the reason, one of the main reasons why we're in the mess we're in today.
Thank you, Newt. Depressing. You've ruined my entire week. I hate to say it.
Sorry.
I was praying and hoping that Newt had finally become irrelevant.
No, I'm afraid his Newt, isn't a Newt, don't they cause a disease? What are Newts? The little lizards?
You're right, whether or not it's identified by the AMDA or not.
I think they're little lizards that cause disease. Now, I'm not a biologist. I may be wrong about that. Correct me, you know, folks, if I don't.
Well, but
Eye of Newt. Yeah, it sounds really dangerous. My point is that this bacteria from Newt Gingrich remains in our political system, and until we get the antibiotic of getting rid of it. And I would suggest there is one powerful antibiotic, only one. We call it the Cipro of the Constitution, to keep my metaphor intact. The Cipro of the Constitution is located in Section 4 of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which says, the validity of the public debt authorized by law shall not be questioned. It comes out of the Civil War. It comes out of Lincoln paying our debts. And it's never been invoked by any president of the United States. Mr. President, use the antibiotic that will finally kill the Newt that remains in our system.
And maybe even the Eye of Newt.
Seriously, I think he's got to invoke the 14th Amendment, and I think it's the only way out. And if we get close to actually defaulting the national debt, I think President Obama needs to reconsider and invoke that clause. That's it for the Raucous Caucus. That's all the time we have. If they were to find you, where would they find you?
Dr. of Democracy at AOL.com.
Dr. of Democracy at AOL.com. And this is Mark Levine. You can find me at MarkLevineTalk.com. You can follow me on Twitter at MarkLevineTalk. And also find me on Facebook, by all means. Go to Facebook.com/MarkLevineTalk and come join my page and talk to us. But that's all we have for the Raucous Caucus. We are here every Sunday at noon on We Act Radio and also live on my website, MarkLevineTalk.com. Thank you, Terry, for coming here
Thank
on the
you,
show.
Mark.
Coming up next, we've got the inside scoop. I'm going to give you all the details of the McCutcheon case, the one where the United States Supreme Court is trying to bring bribery back because we don't have enough of it in America. We'll be right back with the inside scoop right after this.
You're listening to WPWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, WeActRadio.com.